When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 25 of The Children of the New Forest by Captain Frederick Marriott. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Nick Whitley, Purley, United Kingdom. Chapter 25. For several days, Edward remained at home, anxiously awaiting every news which arrived, expecting every time that the capture of the king would be announced, and, with great joy, finding that hitherto all efforts had been unsuccessful. But there was a question which now arose in Edward's mind, and which was the cause of deep reflection. Since the proposal of sending his sisters away had been started, he felt the great inconvenience of his still representing himself to the intendant as the grandson of Armitage. His sisters, if sent to the ladies at Portlake, must be sent without the knowledge of the intendant, and if so, the discovery of their absence would soon take place, as Patience Heatherstone would be constantly going over to the cottage. And he now asked himself the question whether, after all the kindness and confidence which the intendant had shown him, he was right in any longer concealing from him his birth and parentage. He felt that he was doing the intendant an injustice in not showing to him that confidence which he deserved. That he was justified in so doing at first, he felt, but since the joining the king's army and the events which had followed, he considered that he was treating the intendant ill, and he now resolved to take the first opportunity of making the confession. But to do it formally, and without some opportunity which might offer, he felt awkward. At last he thought that he would at once make the confession to Patience, under the promise of secrecy. That he might do at once, and after he had done so, the intendant could not tax him with want of confidence altogether. He had now analysed his feelings toward Patience, and he felt how dear she had become to him. During the time he was with the army, she had seldom been out of his thoughts, and although he was often in the society of well-bred women, he saw not one that in his opinion could compare with Patience Heatherstone. But still, what chance had he of supporting a wife? At present, at the age of 19, it was preposterous. Thoughts like these ran in his mind, chasing each other, and followed by others as vague and unsatisfactory, and in the end Edward came to the conclusion that he was without a penny, and that being known as the heir of Beverley would be to his disadvantage, that he was in love with Patience Heatherstone, and had no chance at present of obtaining her, and that he had done well up to the present time in concealing who he was from the intendant, who could safely attest that he knew not that he was protecting the son of so noted a cavalier, and that he would confess to Patience who he was, and give as a reason for not telling her father that he did not wish to commit him by letting him know who it was that was under his protection. How far the reader may be satisfied with the arguments which Edward was satisfied with, we cannot pretend to say. But Edward was young, and hardly knew how to extricate himself from the cloak which necessity had first compelled him to put on. Edward was already satisfied that he was not quite looked upon with indifference by Patience Heatherstone, and he was not yet certain whether it was not a grateful feeling that she had toward him more than any other. That she believed him to be beneath her in birth, he felt convinced, and therefore she could have no idea that he was Edward Beverley. It was not till several days after he had made up his mind that he had an opportunity of being with her alone, as Clara Ratcliffe was their constant companion. However, one evening Clara went out and stayed out so long, carelessly wrapped up, that she caught cold, and the following evening she remained at home, leaving Edward and Patience to take their usual walk unaccompanied by her. They had walked for some minutes in silence, when Patience observed, "You are very grave, Edward, and have been very grave ever since your return. Have you anything to vex you, beyond the failure of the attempt?"
"Yes, I have, Patience. I have much on my conscience, and do not know how to act. I want an adviser and a friend, and know not where to find one."
"Surely, Edward, my father is your sincere friend, and not a bad adviser."
"I grant it, but the question is between your father and me, and I can not advise with him for that reason."
"Then advise with me, Edward. If it is not a secret of such moment that it is not to be trusted to a woman, at all events it will be the advice of a sincere friend. You will give me credit for that."
"Yes, and for much more, for I think I shall have good advice, and will therefore accept your offer.
I feel, Patience, that although I was justified on my first acquaintance with your father in not making known to him a secret of some importance, yet now that he has put such implicit confidence in me, I am doing him and myself an injustice in not making the communication. That is, as far as confidence in him is concerned. I consider that he has a right to know all, and yet I feel that it would be prudent on my part that he should not know all, as the knowledge might implicate him with those with whom he is at present allied. A secret sometimes is dangerous, and if your father could not say that on his honour he knew not of the secret, it might harm him if the secret became afterward known. Do you understand me?"
"I can not say that I exactly do." "You have a secret that you wish to make known to my father, and you think the knowledge of it may harm him. I can not imagine what kind of secret that may be."
"Well, I can give you a case in point. Suppose now that I knew that King Charles was hidden in your stable loft. Such might be the case, and your father be ignorant of it, and his assertion of his ignorance would be believed. But if I were to tell your father that the king was there, and it was afterward discovered, do you not see that by confiding such a secret to him, I should do harm, and perhaps bring him into trouble?"
"I perceive now, Edward. Do you mean to say that you know where the king is concealed? For if you do, I must beg of you not to let my father know anything about it. As you say, it would put him in a difficult position, and must eventually harm him much. There is a great difference between wishing well to a cause and supporting it in person. My father wishes the king well, I believe, but at the same time he will not take an active part, as you have already seen. At the same time, I am convinced that he would never betray the king if he knew where he was. I say, therefore, if that is your secret, keep it from him for his sake and for mine, Edward, if you regard me."
"You know not how much I regard you, Patience. I saw many high-born women when I was away, but none could I see equal to Patience Heatherstone, in my opinion, and Patience was ever in my thoughts during my long absence."
"I thank you for your kind feelings toward me," replied Patience, "but, Master Armitage, we were talking about your secret." Master Armitage," rejoined Edward, "how well you know how to remind me by that expression of my obscure birth and parentage, whenever I am apt to forget the distance which I ought to observe."
"You are wrong," replied Patience, "but you flattered me so grossly that I called you Master Armitage to show that I disliked flattery. That was all. I dislike flattery from those who are above me in rank, as well as those who are below me, and I should have done the same to any other person, whatever his condition might be. But forget what I said. I did not mean to vex you, only to punish you for thinking me so silly as to believe such nonsense."
"Your humility may construe that into flattery, which was said by me in perfect sincerity and truth that I cannot help," replied Edward. "I might have added much more, and yet have been sincere. If you had not reminded me of my not being of gentle birth, I might have had the presumption to have told you much more, but I have been rebuked."
Edward finished speaking, and Patience made no reply. They walked on for several moments without exchanging another syllable. At last Patience said,
"I will not say who is wrong, Edward, but this I do know, that the one who first offers the olive branch after a misunderstanding can not but be right. I offer it now, and ask you whether we are to quarrel about one little word. Let me ask you, and give me a candid answer. Have I ever been so base as to treat as an inferior one to whom I have been so much obliged?"
"It is I who am in fault, Patience," replied Edward. "I have been dreaming for a long while, pleased with my dreams, and forgetting that they were dreams and not likely to be realized. I must now speak plainly. I love you, Patience, love you so much that to part from you would be misery. To know that my love was rejected as bitter as death, that is the truth, and I can conceal it no longer. Now, I admit you have a right to be angry."
"I see no cause for anger, Edward," replied Patience. "I have not thought of you but as a friend and benefactor. It would have been wrong to have done otherwise. I am but a young person, and must be guided by my father. I would not offend him by disobedience. I thank you for your good opinion of me, and yet I wish you had not said what you have. Am I to understand from your reply that if your father raised no objection, my lowly birth would be none in your opinion?"
"Your birth has never come into my head, except when reminded of it by yourself."
"Then, Patience, let me return for the present to what I had to confide in you. I was..."
"Here comes my father, Edward," said Patience. "Surely I have done wrong, for I feel afraid to meet him."
Mr. Heatherstone now joined them, and said to Edward,
"I have been looking for you. I have news from London which has rejoiced me much. I have at last obtained what I have some time been trying for, and indeed I may say that your prudence and boldness in returning home as a trooper, added to your conduct in the forest, has greatly advanced and ultimately obtained for me my suit. There was some suspense before that, but your conduct has removed it, and now we shall have plenty to do."
They walked to the house, and the intendant, as soon as he had gained his own room, said to Edward,
"There is a grant to me of a property which I have long solicited for my services. Read it."
Edward took up the letter in which the Parliament informed Mr. Heatherstone that his application to the property of Arnwood had been acceded to, and signed by the commissioners, and that he might take immediate possession. Edward turned pale as he laid the document down on the table.
"We will ride tomorrow, Edward, and look it over. I intend to rebuild the house."
Edward made no reply.
"Are you not well?"
said the intendant with surprise.
"Yes, sir," replied Edward. "I am well, I believe.
but I confess to you that I am disappointed. I did not think that you would have accepted a property from such a source, and so unjustly sequestrated."
"I am sorry, Edward," replied the intendant, "that I should have fallen in your good opinion, but allow me to observe that you are so far right that I never would have accepted a property to which there were living claimants. But this is a different case. For instance, the Ratcliffe property belongs to little Clara, and is sequestrated. Do you think I would accept it? Never. But here is a property without an heir. The whole family perished in the flames of Arnwood. There is no living claimant. It must be given to somebody, or remain with the government. This property, therefore, and this property only, out of all sequestrated, I selected, as I felt that, in obtaining it, I did harm to no one. I have been offered others, but have refused them. I would accept of this, and this only, and that is the reason why my applications have hitherto been attended with no success. I trust you believe me, Edward, in what I assert."
"First answer me one question, Mr. Heatherstone. Suppose it were proved that the whole of the family did not, as is supposed, perish at the conflagration of Arnwood. Suppose a rightful heir to it should at any time appear. Would you then resign the property to him?"
"As I hope for heaven, Edward, I would," replied the intendant, solemnly raising his eyes upward as he spoke. "I then should think that I had been an instrument to keep the property out of other hands less scrupulous, and should surrender it as a trust, which had been confided to me for the time only."
"With such feelings, Mr. Heatherstone, I can now congratulate you upon your having obtained possession of the property," replied Edward.
"And yet I do not deserve so much credit, as there is little chance of my sincerity being put to the test, Edward. There is no doubt that the family all perished, and Arnwood will become the dower of Patience Heatherstone."
Edward's heart beat quick. A moment's thought told him his situation. He had been prevented by the interruption of Mr. Heatherstone from making his confession to Patience, and now he could not make it to anybody without a rupture with the intendant, or a compromise by asking what he so earnestly desired, the hand of Patience. Mr. Heatherstone, observing to Edward that he did not look well, said supper was ready, and that they had better go into the next room. Edward mechanically followed. At supper he was tormented by the incessant inquiries of Clara as to what was the matter with him. He did not venture to look at Patience, and made a hasty retreat to bed, complaining, as he might well do, of a severe headache. Edward threw himself on his bed, but to sleep was impossible. He thought of the events of the day over and over again. Had he any reason to believe that Patience returned his affection? No. Her reply was too calm, too composed, to make him suppose that, and now that she would be an heiress, there would be no want of pretenders to her hand, and he would lose her and his property at the same time. It was true that the intendant had declared that he would renounce the property if the true heir appeared, but that was easy to say upon the conviction that no heir would appear. And even if he did renounce it, the Parliament would receive it again rather than it should fall into the hands of a Beverley. "Oh, that I had never left the cottage," thought Edward. "I might then at least have become resigned and contented with my lot. Now I am miserable, and whichever way I turn, I see no prospect of being otherwise. One thing only I can decide upon, which is that I will not remain any longer than I can help under this roof. I will go over and consult with Humphrey, and if I can only place my sisters as I want, Humphrey and I will seek our fortunes." Edward rose at daylight, and, dressing himself,
went down and saddled his horse. Desiring Sampson to tell the intendant that he had gone over to the cottage and would return by the evening, he rode across the forest and arrived just as they were sitting down to breakfast. His attempts to be cheerful before his sisters did not succeed, and they were all grieved to see him look so pale and haggard. As soon as breakfast was over, Edward made a sign, and he and Humphrey went out. "What is the matter, my dear brother?" said Humphrey. "I will tell you all. Listen to me," replied Edward, who then gave him the detail of all that had passed from the time he had walked out with Patience Heatherstone till he went to bed. "Now, Humphrey, you know all, and what shall I do? Remain there I cannot." "If Patience Heatherstone had professed regard for you," replied Humphrey, "the affair had been simple enough. Her father could have no objections to the match, and he would at the same time have acquitted his conscience as to the retaining of the property. But you say she showed none."
"She told me very calmly that she was sorry that I had said what I did."
"But do women always mean what they say, brother?" said Humphrey.
"She does, at all events," replied Edward. "She is truth itself. No, I cannot deceive myself. She feels a deep debt of gratitude for the service I rendered her, and that prevented her from being more harsh in her reply than what she was."
"But if she knew that you were Edward Beverley, do you not think it would make a difference in her?"
"And if it did, it would be too humiliating to think that I was only married for my rank and station."
"But considering you of mean birth, may she not have checked those feelings which she considered under the circumstances improper to indulge?"
"Where there is such a sense of propriety, there can be little affection."
"I know nothing about these things, Edward," replied Humphrey, "but I have been told that a woman's heart is not easily read, or, if I have not been told it, I have read it or dreamt it. What do you propose to do?"
"What I fear you will not approve of, Humphrey. It is to break up our establishment altogether. If the answer is favorable from the Misses Cunningham, my sisters shall go to them, but that we had agreed upon already. Then, for myself, I intend to go abroad, resume my name, and obtain employment in some foreign service. I will trust to the king for assisting me to that."
"That is the worst part of it, Edward. But if your peace of mind depends upon it, I will not oppose it."
"You, Humphrey, may come with me and share my fortunes, or do what you think more preferable."
"I think then, Edward, that I shall not decide rashly. I must have remained here with Pablo if my sisters had gone to the ladies Cunningham and you had remained with the intendant. I shall therefore, till I hear from you, remain where I am, and shall be able to observe what is going on here, and let you know."
"Be it so," replied Edward. "Let me only see my sisters well placed, and I shall be off the next day. It is misery to remain there now."
After some more conversation, Edward mounted his horse and returned to the intendant's. He did not arrive till late, for supper was on the table. The intendant gave him a letter for Mr. Chaloner, which was enclosed in one from Mr. Langton, and further informed Edward that news had arrived of the king having made his escape to France.
"Thank God for that!"
exclaimed Edward.
"With your leave, sir, I will tomorrow deliver this letter to the party to whom it is addressed, as I know it to be of consequence."
The intendant having given his consent, Edward retired without having exchanged a word with Patience or Clara, beyond the usual civilities of the table. The following morning, Edward, who had not slept an hour during the night, set off for Clara's cottage, and found Chaloner and Grenville still in bed. At the sound of his voice, the door was opened, and he gave Chaloner the letter. The latter read it, and then handed it to Edward. The Misses Cunningham were delighted at the idea of receiving the two daughters of Colonel Beverley, and would treat them as their own. They requested that they might be sent to London immediately, where the coach would meet them to convey them down to Lancashire. They begged to be kindly remembered to Captain Beverley, and to assure him that his sisters should be well cared for. "I am much indebted to you, Chaloner," said Edward. "I will send my brother off with my sisters as soon as possible. You will soon think of returning to France, and if you will permit me, I will accompany you."
"You, Edward? That will be delightful. But you had no idea of the kind when last we met. What has induced you to alter your mind?"
"I will tell you by and by. I do not think I shall be here again for some days. I must be a great deal at the cottage when Humphrey is away, for Pablo will have a great charge upon him, what with the dairy and horses and breed of goats and other things, more than he can attend to. But as soon as Humphrey returns, I will come to you and make preparations for our departure. Till then, farewell, both of you. We must see to provision you for 3 weeks or a month before Humphrey starts." Edward bade them a hearty farewell, and then rode to the cottage. Although Alice and Edith had been somewhat prepared for leaving the cottage, yet the time was so very uncertain that the blow fell heavy upon them. They were to leave their brothers, whom they loved so dearly, to go to strangers, and when they understood that they were to leave in 2 days, and that they should not see Edward again, their grief was very great. But Edward reasoned with Alice and consoled her, although with Edith it was a more difficult task. She not only lamented her brothers, but her cow, her pony, and her kids. All the dumb animals were friends and favorites of Edith, and even the idea of parting with Pablo was the cause of a fresh burst of tears. Having made every arrangement with Humphrey, Edward once more took his leave, promising to come over and assist Pablo as soon as he could. The next day, Humphrey was busied in his preparations. They supplied the provisions to Clara's cottage, and when Pablo took them over in the cart, Humphrey rode to Lymington and provided a conveyance to London for the following day. We may as well observe that they set off at the hour appointed, and arrived safely at London in 3 days. There, at an address given in a letter, they found the coach waiting, and having given his sisters into the charge of an elderly waiting woman, who had come up in the coach to take charge of them, they quitted him with many tears, and Humphrey hastened back to the New Forest. On his return, he found to his surprise that Edward had not called at the cottage as he had promised, and with a mind foreboding evil, he mounted a horse and set off across the forest to ascertain the cause. As he was close to the intendant's house, he was met by Oswald, who informed him that Edward had been seized with a violent fever, and was in a very dangerous state, having been delirious for 3 or 4 days. Humphrey hastened to dismount, and knocked at the door of the house. It was opened by Sampson, and Humphrey requested to be shown up to his brother's room. He found Edward in the state described by Oswald, and wholly unconscious of his presence. The maid, Phoebe, was by his bedside.
"You may leave," said Humphrey rather abruptly. "I am his brother."
Phoebe retired, and Humphrey was alone with his brother.
"It was indeed an unhappy day when you came to this house," exclaimed Humphrey, as the tears rolled down his cheeks. "My poor, poor Edward."
Edward now began to talk incoherently, and attempted to rise from the bed, but his efforts were unavailing. He was too weak. But he raved of Patience Heatherstone, and he called himself Edward Beverley more than once, and he talked of his father and of Arnwood.
"If he has raved in this manner," thought Humphrey, "he has not many secrets left to disclose. I will not leave him, and will keep others away if I can."
Humphrey had been sitting an hour with his brother when the surgeon came to see his patient. He felt his pulse, and asked Humphrey if he was nursing him.
"I am his brother, sir," replied Humphrey.
"Then, my good sir, if you perceive any signs of perspiration,
and I think now that there is a little. Keep the clothes on him, and let him perspire freely. If so, his life will be saved."
The surgeon withdrew, saying that he would return again late in the evening. Humphrey remained for another 2 hours at the bedside, and then, feeling that there was a sign of perspiration, he obeyed the injunctions of the surgeon, and held on the clothes against all Edward's endeavours to throw them off. For a short time the perspiration was profuse, and the restlessness of Edward subsided into a deep slumber.
"Thank heaven there are then hopes!"
"Did you say there were hopes?" repeated a voice behind him.
Humphrey turned round, and perceived Patience and Clara behind him, who had come in without his observing it.
"Yes," replied Humphrey, looking reproachfully at Patience, "there are hopes, by what the surgeon said to me, hopes that he may yet be able to quit this house which he was so unfortunate as to enter."
This was a harsh and rude speech of Humphrey, but he considered that Patience Heatherstone had been the cause of his brother's dangerous state, and that she had not behaved well to him. Patience made no reply, but falling down on her knees by the bedside, prayed silently, and Humphrey's heart smote him for what he had said to her.
"She cannot be so bad,"
thought Humphrey, as Patience and Clara quitted the room without the least noise. Shortly afterward, the intendant came up into the room and offered his hand to Humphrey, who pretended not to see it and did not take it.
"He has got onward, that is enough for him," thought Humphrey, "but my hand in friendship he shall not receive."
The intendant put his hand within the clothes, and feeling the high perspiration that Edward was in, said,
"I thank thee, O God, for all thy mercies, and that thou hast been pleased to spare this valuable life." "How are your sisters, Master Humphrey?"
said the intendant.
"My daughter bade me inquire. I will send over to them, and let them know that your brother is better, if you do not leave this for the cottage yourself, after the surgeon has called again."
"My sisters are no longer at the cottage, Master Heatherstone," replied Humphrey.
"They have gone to some friends who have taken charge of them. I saw them safe to London myself, or I should have known of my brother's illness, and have been here before this."
"You indeed tell me news, Master Humphrey," replied the intendant.
"With whom, may I ask, are your sisters placed, and in what capacity are they gone?"
This reply of the intendant's reminded Humphrey that he had somewhat committed himself, as being supposed to be the daughters of a forester, it was not to be thought that they had gone up to be educated, and he therefore replied,
"They found it lonely in the forest, Master Heatherstone, and wished to see London, so we have taken them there, and put them into the care of those who have promised that they shall be well placed."
The intendant appeared to be much disturbed and surprised, but he said nothing, and soon afterward quitted the room. He almost immediately returned with the surgeon, who, as soon as he felt Edward's pulse, declared that the crisis was over, and that when he awoke he would be quite sensible. Having given directions as to the drink of his patient, and some medicine which he was to take, the surgeon then left, stating that he should not call until the next evening, unless he was sent for, as he considered all danger over. Edward continued in a quiet slumber for the major portion of the night. It was just break of day when he opened his eyes. Humphrey offered him some drink, which Edward took greedily, and seeing Humphrey, said,
"Oh, Humphrey, I had quite forgotten where I was. I'm so sleepy."
And with these words his head fell on the pillow, and he was again asleep. When it was broad daylight, Oswald came into the room.
"Master Humphrey, they say that all danger is over now, but that you have remained here all night. I will relieve you now, if you will let me. Go and take a walk in the fresh air. It will revive you."
"I will, Oswald, and many thanks. My brother has woke up once, and I thank God is quite sensible. He will know you when he wakes again, and then do you send for me." Humphrey left the room, and was glad, after a night of close confinement in a sick room, to feel the cool morning air fanning his cheeks. He had not been long out of the house before he perceived Clara coming toward him.
"How d'ye do, Humphrey?" said Clara. "And how is your brother this morning?"
"He is better, Clara, and I hope now out of danger."
"But, Humphrey," continued Clara, "when we came into the room last night, what made you say what you did?"
"I do not recollect that I said anything."
"Yes, you did. You said that there were now hopes that your brother would be able soon to quit this house, which he had been so unfortunate as to enter. Do you recollect?"
"I may have said so, Clara," replied Humphrey. "I was only speaking my thoughts aloud."
"But why do you think so, Humphrey? Why has Edward been unfortunate in entering this house? That is what I want to know. Patience cried so much after she left the room because you said that. Why did you say so? You did not think so a short time ago."
"No, my dear Clara, I did not, but I do now, and I can not give you my reasons, so you must say no more about it."
Clara was silent for a time, and then said, "Patience tells me that your sisters have gone away from the cottage. You told her father so."
"It is very true. They have gone."
"But why have they gone? What are they gone for? Who is to look after the cows and goats and poultry? Who is to cook your dinner, Humphrey? What can you do without them? And why did you send them away without letting me or Patience know that they were going, so that at least we might have bid them farewell?"
"My dear Clara,"
replied Humphrey, who, feeling no little difficulty in replying to all these questions, resolved to cut the matter short by appearing to be angry,
"you know that you are the daughter of a gentleman, and so is Patience Heatherstone. You are both of gentle birth, but my sisters, you know, are only the daughters of a forester, and my brother Edward and I are no better. It does not become Mistress Patience and you to be intimate with such as we are, especially now that Mistress Patience is a great heiress, for her father has obtained the large property of Arnwood, and it will be hers after his death. It is not fit that the heiress of Arnwood should mix herself up with foresters' daughters. And as we had friends near Lymington who offered to assist us, and take our sisters under their charge, we thought it better that they should go. For what would become of them if any accident was to happen to Edward or to me? Now they will be provided for. After they have been taught, they will make very nice tire women to some lady of quality," added Humphrey with a sneer. "Don't you think they will, my pretty Clara?"
Clara burst into tears.
"You are very unkind, Humphrey,"
sobbed she.
"You had no right to send away your sisters. I don't believe you, that's more."
And Clara ran away into the house. End of chapter 25. Recording by Nick Whitley, Purley, United Kingdom.
Chapter 26 of The Children of the New Forest by Captain Frederick Marriott. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Nick Whitley, Purley, United Kingdom. Chapter 26. Our readers may think that Humphrey was very unkind, but it was to avoid being questioned by Clara, who was evidently sent for the purpose, that he was so harsh. At the same time, it must be admitted that Mr. Heatherstone, having obtained possession of Arnwood, rankled, no doubt, in the minds of both the brothers, and every act now on the part of him or his family was viewed in a false medium. But our feelings are not always at our control, and Edward was naturally impetuous, and Humphrey so much attached and so much alarmed at his brother's danger, that he was even more excited. The blow fell doubly heavy, as it appeared that at the very same time Patience had rejected his brother and taken possession of their property, which had been held by the family for centuries.
What made the case more annoying was that explanation, if there was any to offer on either side, was, under present circumstances, almost impossible. Soon after Clara left him, Humphrey returned to his brother's room. He found him awake and talking to Oswald. Ardently pressing his brother's hand, Edward said, "My dear Humphrey, I shall soon be well now, and able, I trust, to quit this house. What I fear is that some explanation will be asked for by the intendant, not only relative to my sister's having left us, but also upon other points. This is what I wish to avoid without giving offence. I do not think that the intendant is so much to blame in having obtained my property, as he does not know that a Beverley existed, but I can not bear to have any further intimacy with him, especially after what has taken place between me and his daughter. What I have to request is that you will never quit this room while I am still here, unless you are relieved by Oswald, so that the intendant or anybody else may have no opportunity of having any private communication with me, or forcing me to listen to what they may have to say. I made this known to Oswald before you came in."
"Depend upon it, it shall be so, Edward, for I am of your opinion. Clara came to me just now, and I had much trouble, and was compelled to be harsh to get rid of her importunity."
When the surgeon called, he pronounced Edward out of danger, and that his attendance would be no longer necessary. Edward felt the truth of this. All that he required was strength, and that he trusted in a few days to obtain. Oswald was sent over to the cottage to ascertain how Pablo was going on by himself. He found that everything was correct, and that Pablo, although he felt proud of his responsibility, was very anxious for Humphrey's return, as he found himself very lonely. During Oswald's absence on this day, Humphrey never quitted the room, and although the intendant came up several times, he never could find an opportunity of speaking to Edward, which he evidently wished to do. To the inquiries made as to how he was, Edward always complained of great weakness, for a reason which will soon be understood. Several days elapsed, and Edward had often been out of bed during the night, when not likely to be intruded upon, and he now felt himself strong enough to be removed, and his object was to leave the intendant's house without his knowledge, so as to avoid an explanation. One evening Pablo came over with the horses after it was dark. Oswald put them into the stable, and the morning proving fine and clear, a little before break of day Edward came softly downstairs with Humphrey, and mounting the horses, set off for the cottage, without any one of the intendant's house being aware of their departure. It must not be supposed, however, that Edward took this step without some degree of consideration as to the feelings of the intendant. On the contrary, he left a letter with Oswald, to be delivered after his departure, in which he thanked the intendant sincerely for all the kindness and compassion he had shown toward him, assured him of his gratitude and kind feelings toward him and his daughter, but said that circumstances had occurred of which no explanation could be given without great pain to all parties, which rendered it advisable that he should take such an apparently unkind step as to leave without bidding them farewell in person, that he was about to embark immediately for the Continent to seek his fortune in the wars, and that he wished all prosperity to the family, which would ever have his kindest wishes and remembrances. "Humphrey," said Edward, after they had ridden about 2 miles across the forest, and the sun had risen in an unclouded sky, "I feel like an emancipated slave. Thank God! My sickness has cured me of all my complaints, and all I want now is active employment. And now, Humphrey, Chaloner and Grenville are not a little tired of being mured up in the cottage, and I am as anxious as they are to be off. What will you do? Will you join us,
or will you remain at the cottage?"
"I have reflected upon it, Edward, and I have come to the determination of remaining at the cottage. You will find it expensive enough to support one where you are going, and you must appear as a Beverley should do.
We have plenty of money saved to equip you and maintain you well for a year or so, but after that you may require more. Leave me here. I can make money now that the farm is well stocked, and I have no doubt that I shall be able to send over a trifle every year to support the honour of the family. Besides, I do not wish to leave this for another reason. I want to know what is going on, and watch the motions of the intendant and the heiress of Arnwood. I do not wish to leave the country until I know how my sisters get on with the ladies Cunningham. It is my duty to watch over them. I have made up my mind, so do not attempt to dissuade me. I shall not, my dear Humphrey, as I think you have decided properly. But I beg you will not think of laying by money for me. A very little will suffice for my wants.
Not so, good brother. You must, and shall, if I can help you, ruffle it with the best. You will be better received if you do, for though poverty is no sin, as the saying is, it is scouted as sin should be, while sins are winked at. You know that I require no money, and therefore you must, and shall, if you love me, take it all.
As you will, my dear Humphrey. Now then, let us put our horses to speed, for if possible we will tomorrow morning leave the forest. By this time all search for the fugitives from Worcester had long been over, and there was no difficulty in obtaining the means of embarkation. Early the next morning everything was ready, and Edward, Humphrey, Chaloner, Grenville, and Pablo set off for Southampton, one of the horses carrying the little baggage which they had with them. Edward, as we have before mentioned, with the money he had saved, and the store at the cottage, which had been greatly increased, was well supplied with cash. That evening they embarked with their horses in a small sailing vessel, and with a favourable light wind arrived at a small port of France on the following day. Humphrey and Pablo returned to the cottage, we need hardly now say, very much out of spirits at the separation.
"Oh, Massa Humphrey," said Pablo, as they rode along, "Missy Alice and Missy Edith go away. I wish go with them. Massa Edward go away. I wish go with him. You stay at cottage. I wish stay with you. Pablo cannot be in three places."
"No, Pablo. All you can do is to stay where you can be most useful."
"Yes, I know that. You want me at cottage very much. Missy Alice and Edith and Massa Edward no want me, so I stay at cottage."
"Yes, Pablo, we will stay at the cottage, but we can't do everything now. I think we must give up the dairy now that my sisters are gone. I'll tell you what I have been thinking of, Pablo. We will make a large enclosed place to coax the ponies into during the winter, pick out as many as we think are good, and sell them at Lymington. That will be better than churning butter."
"Yes, I see. Plenty of work for Pablo."
"And plenty for me too, Pablo. But you know, when the enclosure is once made, it will last for a long while, and we will get the wild cattle into it if we can."
"Yes, I see," said Pablo. "I like that very much. Only not like trouble to build place."
"We shan't have much trouble, Pablo. If we fell the trees inside the wood at each side, and let them lie one upon the other, the animals will never break through them."
"That very good idea. Save trouble," said Pablo. "And what do you do with cows, suppose no make butter?"
"Keep them, and sell their calves. Keep them to entice the wild cattle into the pen."
"Yes, that good. And turn out old Billy to tice ponies into pen,"
continued Pablo, laughing. "Yes, we will try it. We must now return to the intendant's house." Oswald delivered the letter to the intendant, who read it with much astonishment.
"Gone? Is he actually gone?" said Mr. Heatherstone.
"Yes, sir,
before daylight this morning." "And why was I not informed of it?"
said Mr. Heatherstone.
"Why have you been a party to this proceeding, being my servant? May I inquire that?"
"I knew Master Edward before I knew you, sir," replied Oswald.
"Then you had better follow him,"
rejoined the intendant in an angry tone.
"Very well, sir," replied Oswald, who quitted the room. "Good heaven! How all my plans have been frustrated!"
exclaimed the intendant when he was alone. He then read the letter over more carefully than he had done at first.
"Circumstances had occurred of which no explanation could be given by him. I do not comprehend that. I must see Patience."
Mr. Heatherstone opened the door and called to his daughter.
"Patience,"
said Mr. Heatherstone,
"Edward has left the house this morning. Here is a letter which he has written to me. Read it, and let me know if you can explain some portion of it, which to me is incomprehensible. Sit down and read it attentively."
Patience, who was much agitated, gladly took the seat and perused Edward's letter. When she had done so, she let it drop in her lap and covered all her face, the tears trickling through her fingers. After a time, the intendant said,
"Patience, has anything passed between you and Edward Armitage?"
Patience made no reply, but sobbed aloud. She might not have shown so much emotion, but it must be remembered that for the last 3 weeks since Edward had spoken to her, and during his subsequent illness, she had been very unhappy. The reserve of Humphrey, the expressions he had made use of, his repulse of Clara, and her not having seen anything of Edward during his illness, added to his sudden and unexpected departure without a word to her, had broken her spirits, and she sank beneath the load of sorrow. The intendant left her to recover herself before he again addressed her. When she had ceased sobbing, her father spoke to her in a very kind voice, begging her that she would not conceal anything from him, as it was most important to him that the real facts should be known.
"Now, tell me, my child, what passed between Edward and you?"
"He told me just before you came up to us that evening that he loved me."
"And what was your reply?"
"I hardly know, my dear father, what it was that I said. I did not like to be unkind to one who saved my life, and I did not choose to say what I thought because he was of low birth, and how could I give encouragement to the son of a forester without your permission?"
"Then you rejected him?"
"I suppose I did, or that he considered that I did so. He had a secret of importance that he would have confided to me had you not interrupted us."
"And now, Patience, I must request you to answer me one question candidly. I do not blame you for your conduct, which was correct under the circumstances. I also had a secret, which I perhaps ought to have confided, but I did consider that the confidence and paternal kindness with which I treated Edward would have been sufficient to point out to you that I could not have been very averse to a union. Indeed, the freedom of communication which I allowed between you must have told you so, but your sense of duty and propriety has made you act as you ought to have done, I grant, although contrary to my real wishes."
"Your wishes, my father?" said Patience.
"Yes, my wishes. There is nothing that I so ardently desired as a union between you and Edward. But I wished you to love him for his own merits."
"I have done so, father," replied Patience, sobbing again, "although I did not tell him so."
The intendant remained silent for some time, and then said,
"There is no cause for further concealment, Patience. I have only to regret that I was not more explicit sooner. I have long suspected, and have since been satisfied,
that Edward Armitage is Edward Beverley, who with his brothers and sisters were supposed to have been burned to death at Arnwood.
Patience removed her handkerchief from her face and looked at her father with astonishment.
"I tell you that I had a strong suspicion of it, my dear child, first from the noble appearance, which no forest garb could disguise. But what gave me further conviction was that when at Lymington I happened to fall in with one Benjamin, who had been a servant at Arnwood, and interrogated him closely. He really believed that the children were burnt. It is true that I asked him, particularly relative to the appearance of the children, how many were boys, and how many were girls, their ages, etc. But the strongest proof was that the names of the four children corresponded with the names of the children of the forest, as well as their ages, and I went to the church register and extracted them. Now this was almost amounting to proof, for it was not likely that four children in the forest cottage should have the same ages and names as those of Arnwood. After I had ascertained this point, I engaged Edward, as you know, wishing to secure him, for I was once acquainted with his father, and at all events well acquainted with the colonel's merits. You remained in the house together, and it was with pleasure that I watched the intimacy between you, and then I exerted myself to get Arnwood restored to him. I could not ask it for him, but I prevented it being given to any other by laying claim to it myself. Had Edward remained with us, all might have succeeded as I wished, but he would join in the unfortunate insurrection. I knew it was useless to prevent him, so I let him go. I found that he took the name of Beverley during the time he was with the king's army, and when I was last in town, I was told so by the commissioners, who wondered where he had come from. But the effect was that it was now useless for me to request the estate for him, as I had wished to do. His having served in the royal army rendered it impossible. I therefore claimed it for myself, and succeeded. I had made up my mind that he was attached to you, and you were equally so to him, and as soon as I had the grant sent down, which was on the evening he addressed you, I made known to him that the property was given to me, and I added, on some dry questions being put to me by him, relative to the possibility of there being still existing an heir to the estate, that there was no chance of that, and that you would be the mistress of Arnwood. I threw it out as a hint to him, fancying that, as far as you were concerned, all would go well, and that I would explain to him my knowledge of who he was after he had made known his regard for you.
"Yes, I see it all now," replied Patience. "In one hour he is rejected by me, and in the next he is told that I have obtained possession of his property. No wonder that he is indignant, and looks upon us with scorn. And now he has left us, we have driven him into danger, and may never see him again. Oh, father, I am very, very miserable."
"We must hope for the best, Patience. It is true that he has gone to the wars, but it does not therefore follow that he is to be killed. You are both very young, much too young to marry, and all may be explained. I must see Humphrey and be candid with him."
"But Alice and Edith, where are they gone, father?"
"That I can inform you. I have a letter from Langton on the subject, for I begged him to find out. He says that there are two young ladies of the name of Beverley, who have been placed under the charge of his friends, the ladies Cunningham, who is aunt to Major Challoner, who has been for some time concealed in the forest. But I have letters to write, my dear Patience. Tomorrow, if I live and do well, I will ride over to the cottage to see Humphrey Beverley.
The intendant kissed his daughter, and she left the room. Poor Patience! She was glad to be left to herself and think over this strange communication. For many days she had felt how fond she had been of Edward, much more so than she had believed herself to be. And now, she thought, if he really loves me, and hears my father's explanation, he will come back again. By degrees she recovered her serenity, and employed herself in her quiet domestic duties. Mr. Heatherstone rode over to the cottage the next day, where he found Humphrey busily employed as usual, and, what is very unusual, extremely grave. It was not a pleasant task for Mr. Heatherstone to have to explain his conduct to so very young a man as Humphrey, but he felt that he could not be comfortable until the evil impression against him was removed, and he knew that Humphrey had a great deal of sterling good sense. His reception was cool, but when the explanation was made, Humphrey was more than satisfied, as it showed that the intendant had been their best friend, and that it was from a delicacy on the part of Patience, rather than from any other cause, that the misunderstanding had occurred. Humphrey inquired if he had permission to communicate the substance of their conversation to his brother, and Mr. Heatherstone stated that such was his wish and intention when he confided it to Humphrey. It is hardly necessary to say that Humphrey took the earliest opportunity of writing to Edward at the direction which Chaloner had left with him. End of chapter 26. Recording by Nick Whitley, Purley, United Kingdom. Chapter 27 of The Children of the New Forest by Captain Frederick Marriott. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Nick Whitley, Purley, United Kingdom. Chapter 27. But we must follow Edward for a time. On his arrival at Paris, he was kindly received by King Charles, who promised to assist his views in joining the army.
"You have to choose between two generals, both great in the art of war, Condé and Turenne. I have no doubt that they will be opposed to each other soon. That will be the better for you, as you will learn tactics from such great players."
"Which would your majesty recommend me to follow?" inquired Edward.
"Condé is my favourite, and he will soon be opposed to this truculent and dishonest court, who have kept me here as an instrument to accomplish their own wishes, but who have never intended to keep their promises and place me on the English throne. I will give you letters to Condé, and recollect that whatever general you take service under, you will follow him without pretending to calculate how far his movements may be right or wrong. That is not your affair. Condé is just now released from Vincennes, but depend upon it, he will be in arms very soon."
As soon as he was furnished with the necessary credentials from the king, Edward presented himself at the levee of the Prince of Condé.
"You are here highly spoken of," said the prince, "for so young a man. So you were at the affair of Worcester? We will retain you, for your services will be wanted by and by. Can you procure any of your countrymen?"
"I know but of two that I can recommend from personal knowledge, but these two officers I can venture to pledge myself for."
"Any more?"
"That I cannot at present reply to your highness, but I should think it very possible."
"Bring me the officers tomorrow at this hour, Monsieur Beverley. Au revoir."
The Prince of Condé then passed on to speak to other officers and gentlemen who were waiting to pay their respects. Edward went to Chaloner and Grenville, who were delighted with the intelligence which he brought them. The next day they were at the prince's levee, and introduced by Edward.
"I am fortunate, gentlemen," said the prince,
in securing the services of such fine young men. You will oblige me by enlisting as many of your countrymen as you may consider likely to do good service, and then follow me to Guienne, to which province I am now about to depart. Be pleased to put yourself into communication with the parties named in this paper, and after my absence you will receive from them every assistance and necessary supplies which may be required.
A month after this interview, Condé, who had been joined by a great number of nobles, and had been reinforced by troops from Spain, set up the standard of revolt. Edward and his friends joined them, with about 300 English and Scotch men, which they had enlisted, and very soon afterward Condé obtained the victory at Blenod, and in April 1652 advanced to Paris. Turenne, who had taken the command of the French army, followed him, and a severe action was fought in the streets of the suburb of Saint-Antoine, in which neither party had the advantage. But eventually Condé was beaten back by the superior force of Turenne, and not receiving the assistance he expected from the Spaniards, he fell back to the frontiers of Champagne. Previous to his departure from Paris, Edward had received Humphrey's letter, explaining away the intendant's conduct, and the contents removed a heavy load from Edward's mind. But he now thought of nothing but war, and although he cherished the idea of Patience Heatherstone, he was resolved to follow the fortunes of the prince as long as he could. He wrote a letter to the intendant, thanking him for his kind feelings and intentions toward him, and he trusted that he might one day have the pleasure of seeing him again. He did not, however, think it advisable to mention the name of his daughter, except in inquiring after her health and sending his respects. "It may be years before I see her again," thought Edward, "and who knows what may happen?" The Prince of Condé now had the command of the Spanish forces in the Netherlands, and Edward, with his friends, followed his fortunes and gained his goodwill. They were rapidly promoted. Time flew on, and in the year 1654 the court of France concluded an alliance with Cromwell and expelled King Charles from the French frontiers. The war was still carried on in the Netherlands. Turenne bore down Condé, who had gained every campaign, and the court of Spain, wearied with reverses, made overtures of peace, which was gladly accepted by the French. During these wars, Cromwell had been named Protector, and had shortly afterward died. Edward, who but rarely heard from Humphrey, was now anxious to quit the army and go to the king, who was in Spain. But to leave his colours, while things were adverse, was impossible. After the peace and the pardon of Condé by the French king, the armies were disbanded, and the three adventurers were free. They took their leave of the prince, who thanked them for their long and meritorious services, and they then hastened to King Charles, who had left Spain and come to the Low Countries. At the time of their joining the king, Richard, the son of Cromwell, who had been nominated Protector, had resigned, and everything was ready for the restoration. On the 15th of May, 1660, the news arrived that Charles had been proclaimed king on the 8th, and a large body of gentlemen went to invite him over. The king sailed from Scheveling, was met at Dover by General Monk, and conducted to London, which he entered amid the acclamations of the people on the 29th of the same month. We may leave the reader to suppose that Edward, Chaloner, and Grenville were among the most favoured of those in his train. As the procession moved slowly along the Strand, through a countless multitude, the windows of all the houses were filled with well-dressed ladies, who waved their white kerchiefs to the king and his attendant suite. Chaloner, Edward, and Grenville who rode side by side as gentlemen in waiting, were certainly the most distinguished among the king's retinue.
"Look, Edward," said Chaloner, "at those lovely girls at yon window. Do you recognize them?"
"Indeed I do not. Are they any of our Paris beauties?"
"Why, thou insensible and unnatural animal, they are thy sisters, Alice and Edith, and do you not recognize behind them my good aunt's Cunningham?"
"It is so, I believe," replied Edward. "Yes, now that Edith smiles, I'm sure it is them."
"Yes," replied Grenville, "there can be no doubt of that. But will they think you recognize us?"
"We shall see," replied Edward, as they now approached within a few yards of the window, for while they had been speaking the procession had stopped. "Is it possible," thought Edward, "that these can be the two girls in russet gowns that I left at the cottage? And yet it must be. Well, Chaloner, to all appearance your good aunts have done justice to their charge."
"Nature has done more, Edward. I never thought that they would have grown into such lovely girls as they have, although I always thought that they were handsome."
As they passed, Edward caught the eye of Edith and smiled.
"Alice, that's Edward,"
said Edith, so loud as to be heard by the king and all near him. Alice and Edith rose and waved their handkerchiefs, but they were soon obliged to cease and put them to their eyes.
"Are those your sisters, Edward?"
said the king. "They are, your majesty." The king rose in his stirrups and made a low obeisance to the window where they were standing.
"We shall have some court beauties, Beverley,"
said the king, looking at him over his shoulder. As soon as the ceremonies were over and they could escape from their personal attentions, Edward and his two friends went to the house in which resided the ladies Cunningham and his sisters. We pass over the joy of this meeting after so many years' absence, and the pleasure which it gave to Edward to find his sisters grown such accomplished and elegant young women, that his two friends, who were, as the reader will recollect, old acquaintances of Alice and Edith, were warmly received, we hardly need say.
"Now, Edward, who do you think was here today? The reigning belle and the toast of all the gentlemen?"
"Indeed, I must be careful of my heart. Dear Edith, who is she?"
"No less than one with whom you were formerly well acquainted, Edward, Patience Heatherstone."
"Patience Heatherstone!" cried Edward. "The toast of all London?"
"Yes, and deservedly so, I can assure you. But she is as good as she is handsome, and moreover treats all the gay gallants with perfect indifference. She is staying with her uncle, Sir Ashley Cooper, and her father is also in town, for he called here with her today."
"When did you hear from Humphrey, Edith?"
"A few days back. He has left the cottage now altogether."
"Indeed? Where does he reside, then?"
"At Arnwood. The house has been rebuilt, and I understand is a very princely mansion. Humphrey has charge of it until it is ascertained to whom it is to belong."
"It belongs to Mr. Heatherstone, does it not?" replied Edward.
"How can you say so, Edward? You received Humphrey's letters a long while ago."
"Yes, I did. But let us not talk about it any more, my dear Edith. I am in great perplexity."
"Nay, dear brother, let us talk about it," said Alice, who had come up and overheard the latter portion of the conversation.
"What is your perplexity?"
"Well," replied Edward, "since it is to be so, let us sit down and talk over the matter. I acknowledge the kindness of Mr. Heatherstone, and feel that all he asserted to Humphrey is true. Still, I do not like that I should be indebted to him for a property which is mine, and that he has no right to give. I acknowledge his generosity, but I do not acknowledge his right of possession. Nay, much as I admire, and I may say fond as I am, for time has not effaced the feeling, of his daughter, it still appears to me that although not said, it is expected that she is to be included in the transfer,
and I will accept no wife on such conditions. That is to say, because all you wish for, your property and a woman you love, are offered you in one lot, you will not accept them. They must be divided and handed over to you in two," said Alice, smiling.
"You mistake, dearest. I am not so foolish. But I have a certain pride, which you cannot blame.
Accepting the property from Mr. Heatherstone is receiving a favour, were it given as a marriage portion with his daughter. Now, why should I accept as a favour what I can claim as a right? It is my intention of appealing to the king and demanding the restoration of my property. He cannot refuse it."
"Put not your trust in princes, brother," replied Alice. "I doubt if the king, or his council, will consider it advisable to make so many discontented as to restore property which has been so long held by others, and by so doing create a host of enemies. Recollect also that Mr. Heatherstone and his brother-in-law Sir Ashley Cooper have done the king much more service than you ever have or can do. They have been most important agents in his restoration, and the king's obligations to them are much greater than they are to you. Besides, merely for what may be called a point of honour, for it is no more,
in what an unpleasant situation will you put his majesty?
At all events, Edward, recollect, you do not know what are the intentions of Mr. Heatherstone. Wait and see what he proffers first."
"But, my dear sister, it appears to me that his intentions are evident. Why has he rebuilt Arnwood? He is not going to surrender my property and make me a present of the house."
"The reason for rebuilding the mansion was good. You were at the wars. It was possible that you might or might not return." He said this to Humphrey, who has all along been acting as his factotum in the business. "And recollect, at the time that Mr. Heatherstone commenced the rebuilding of the mansion, what prospect was there of the restoration of the king, or of your ever being in a position to apply for the restoration of your property? I believe, however, that Humphrey knows more of Mr. Heatherstone's intentions than he has made known to us, and I therefore say again, my dear Edward, make no application till you ascertain what Mr. Heatherstone's intentions may be."
"Your advice is good, my dear Alice, and I will be guided by it," replied Edward.
"And now let me give you some advice for your friends, Masters Chaloner and Grenville. That much of their property has been taken away and put into other hands, I know, and probably they expect it will be restored upon their application to the king. Those who hold the property think so too, and so far it is fortunate. Now, from wiser heads than mine, I have been told that these applications will not be acceded to, as is supposed. But at the same time, if they were to meet the parties and close with them at once, before the king's intentions are known, they would recover their property at a third or a quarter of the value. Now is their time. Even a few days' delay may make a difference. They can easily obtain a delay for the payment of the monies. Impress that upon them, my dear Edward, and let them, if possible, be off to their estates to-morrow, and make the arrangements."
"That is advice which must be followed," replied Edward. "We must go now, and I will not fail to communicate it to them this very night."
We may as well here inform the reader that the advice was immediately acted upon, and that Chaloner and Grenville recovered all their estates at about 5 years' purchase. Edward remained at court several days. He had written to Humphrey, and had dispatched a messenger with the letter, but the messenger had not yet returned. The court was now one continual scene of fetes and gaiety. On the following day, a drawing-room was to be held, and Edward's sisters were to be presented. Edward was standing, with many others of the suit, behind the chair of the king, amusing himself with the presentations as they took place, and waiting for the arrival of his sisters. Chaloner and Grenville were not with him. They had obtained leave to go into the country for the object we have before referred to, when his eyes caught, advancing toward the king, Mr. Heatherstone, who led his daughter Patience. That they had not perceived him was evident. Indeed, her eyes were not raised once, from the natural timidity felt by a young woman in the presence of royalty. Edward half concealed himself behind one of his companions, that he might gaze upon her without reserve. She was indeed a lovely young person, but little altered, except having grown taller and more rounded and perfect in her figure, and her court dress displayed proportions which her humble costume at the New Forest had concealed, or which time had not matured. There was the same pensive, sweet expression in her face, which had altered little, but the beautiful rounded arms, the symmetrical fall of the shoulders, and the proportion of the whole figure was a surprise to him, and Edward, in his own mind, agreed that she might well be the reigning toast of the day. Mr. Heatherstone advanced and made his obeisance, and then his daughter was led forward and introduced by a lady unknown to Edward. After he had saluted her, the king said, loud enough for Edward to hear,
"My obligations to your father are great. I trust that the daughter will often grace our court."
Patience made no reply, but passed on, and soon afterward Edward lost sight of her in the crowd. If there ever had been any check to Edward's feelings toward Patience, and time and absence have their effect upon the most ardent of lovers, the sight of her so resplendent in beauty acted upon him like magic, and he was uneasy till the ceremony was over, and he was enabled to go to his sisters. When he entered the room, he found himself in the arms of Humphrey, who had arrived with the messenger. After the greetings were over, Edward said, "Alice and I have seen Patience, and I fear I must surrender at discretion. Mr. Heatherstone may make his own terms. I must waive all pride rather than lose her. I thought that I had more control over myself, but I have seen her, and feel that my future happiness depends upon obtaining her as a wife. Let her father but give me her, and Arnwood will be but a trifle in addition."
"With respect to the conditions upon which you are to possess Arnwood," said Humphrey, "I can inform you what they are. They are wholly unshackled, further than that you are to repay, by instalments, the money expended in the building of the house. This I am empowered to state to you, and I think you will allow that Mr. Heatherstone has fully acted up to what he stated were his views when he first obtained a grant of the property."
"He has indeed," replied Edward.
"As for his daughter, Edward, you have yet to win her and wear her, as the saying is. Her father will resign the property to you as yours by right, but you have no property in his daughter, and I suspect that she will not be quite so easily handed over to you."
"But why should you say so, Humphrey? Have we not been attached from our youth?"
"Yes, it was a youthful passion, I grant. But recollect, nothing came of it, and years have passed away. It is now 7 years since you quitted the forest, and in your letters to Mr. Heatherstone you made no remark upon what had passed between you and Patience. Since that, you have never corresponded or sent any messages, and you can hardly expect that a girl from the age of 17 to 24 will cherish the image of one who, to say the least, had treated her with indifference. That is my view of the matter, Edward. It may be wrong."
"And it may be true," replied Edward mournfully.
"Well, my view is different," replied Edith.
You know, Humphrey, how many offers Patience Heatherstone has had, and has every day, I may say. Why has she refused them all? In my opinion, because she has been constant to a proud brother of mine, who does not deserve her."
"It may be so, Edith," replied Humphrey. "Women are riddles. I only argued upon the common sense of the thing."
"Much you know about women," replied Edith. "To be sure, you do not meet many in the New Forest, where you have lived all your life."
"Very true, my dear sister. Perhaps that is the reason that the New Forest has had such charms for me."
"After that speech, sir, the sooner you get back again the better," retorted Edith.
But Edward made a sign to Humphrey, and they beat a retreat.
"Have you seen the intendant, Humphrey?"
"No, I was about to call upon him, but I wanted to see you first."
"I will go with you. I have not done him justice," replied Edward, "and yet I hardly know how to explain to him."
"Say nothing, but meet him cordially. That will be explanation sufficient."
"I shall meet him as one whom I shall always revere, and feel that I owe a deep debt of gratitude. What must he think of my not having called upon him?"
"Nothing. You hold a place at court. You may not have known that he was in London, as you have never met him. Your coming with me will make it appear so. Tell him that I have just made known to you his noble and disinterested conduct."
"You are right, I will. I fear, however, Humphrey, that you are right and Edith wrong as regards his daughter."
"Nay, Edward, recollect that I have, as Edith observed, passed my life in the woods."
Edward was most kindly received by Mr. Heatherstone. Edward, on Mr. Heatherstone repeating to him his intentions relative to Arnwood, expressed his sense of that gentleman's conduct, simply adding, "You may think me impetuous, sir, but I trust you will believe me grateful." Patience coloured up and trembled when Edward first saw her. Edward did not refer to the past for some time after they had renewed their acquaintance. He wooed her again, and won her. Then all was explained. About a year after the Restoration, there was a fete at Hampton Court, given in honour of three marriages taking place: Edward Beverley to Patience Heatherstone, Chaloner to Alice, and Grenville to Edith.
And, as His Majesty himself said, as he gave away the brides,
"Could loyalty be better rewarded?"
But our young readers will not be content if they do not hear some particulars about the other personages who have appeared in our little history. Humphrey must take the first place. His love of farming continued. Edward gave him a large farm rent-free, and in a few years Humphrey saved up sufficient to purchase a property for himself. He then married Clara Ratcliffe, who has not appeared lately on the scene, owing to her having been, about 2 years before the Restoration, claimed by an elderly relation who lived in the country, and whose infirm state of health did not permit him to quit the house. He left his property to Clara about a year after her marriage to Humphrey. The cottage in the New Forest was held by, and eventually made over to, Pablo, who became a very steady character, and in the course of time married a young girl from Arnwood, and had a houseful of young gypsies. Oswald, so soon as Edward came down to Arnwood, gave up his place in the New Forest, and lived entirely with Edward as his steward. And Phoebe also went to Arnwood, and lived to a good old age in the capacity of housekeeper, her temper becoming rather worse than better as she advanced in years. This is all that we have been able to collect relative to the several parties, and so now we must say farewell.
The End.
End of Chapter 27. Recording by Nick Whitley, Purley, United Kingdom. End of The Children of the New Forest by Captain Frederick Marriott.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.